This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Friday, Australia's regional infrastructure problems under scrutiny again after two people die when a Sydney to Melbourne train comes off the rails. And arrest warrants out for Australian women suspected of fighting for Islamic State. Should we be locking them up or helping them?
The claims to have been tricked or coerced into Syrian territory seem pretty sketchy on what they've told and implausible. So I don't think we should put too much weight on those claims.
First today, the policeman leading the investigation into the murders of Brisbane woman Hannah Clark and her three children has been stood down from the case. It's believed Ms. Clark's estranged husband doused her and their young children in petrol and then set fire to the car they were in. At a media conference yesterday, Detective Inspector Mark Thompson outraged many by saying the investigation would be looking at whether the murders were acts of domestic violence or if it was an instance of a husband being driven too far. Ms. Clark's family and friends are continuing to share their grief and anguish over the deaths, as Sarah Sedgie reports.
It's hard to come to grips with the horror of such a crime. The entire country still seems in shock over what happened to Hannah Clark and her three children, six-year-old Aaliyah, four-year-old Liana and three-year-old Trey. Once again, people are crying out for better protection for women and children. Dr. Heather Nancarro, the chief executive of Australia's National Research Organisation for Women's Safety, doesn't want to see another woman or child lost to violence.
What do we do to ensure that we don't have another homicide next week? Because at the moment in Australia, we're seeing a homicide of a woman every week, and mostly by a current or former intimate partner.
Hannah Clark's father says his daughter's estranged husband, Rowan Baxter, is a monster, and he only cared about himself. Hannah Clark's mother has posted a photo of her daughter and grandchildren with angel wings, while one of her friends who spoke anonymously to the ABC said Hannah Clark endured abusive and controlling behaviour from Rowan Baxter. She says her friend had showed her an injury she sustained to her wrist last week during a conflict. Dr. Heather Nancarro says these patterns are common.
You know, often people will say it just came out of the blue, but there's, the evidence is that there's always signs, and not necessarily always physical violence, but there's always signs of coercive controlling abuse.
And Dr. Nancarro says it's time to consider something drastic to stop preventable violence. A program to monitor men during the transition period after a relationship breakdown.
This is a pretty radical idea, I admit. I'm seeing it as an additional thing that we need to do. But the focus has been mainly around, you know, wrapping services and supports around women and their children to keep them safe. What we haven't done is really target individual men. The reason I'm calling for this is that we can't tell by looking at men which ones are going to, you know, pose such a serious threat to the safety of their ex-partners and children and potentially themselves. But we do have evidence about high risk factors for lethality. But you've got to be able to do a risk assessment and put safety planning or safety measures in place. So the idea of universal screening for men transitioning out of relationships, you know, comes from knowing that separation is high risk for fatality. We know that there are indicators, in those, the behaviour of those men, the coercive controlling nature of the violence, the, you know, what the history of abuse and how that's played out, that would signal that those men need close monitoring and support to transition safely out of relationships.
She's calling for an emergency national summit so experts can work out the details of such a program and other ways to eliminate violence against women and children. Professor Kathy Humphreys researches domestic violence and abuse at the University of Melbourne. She's particularly worried about how the murder of Hannah Clark and her children will affect women in violent and abusive relationships.
One of the things that happens with a violent incident like this is it sends a ripple of fear across women and their children in the community, because there would have been many threats to this woman that she would be killed and her children would be killed if she left. And so there are some problems about the reporting in this space, which can have, you know, potentially a contagion effect. And potentially also, you know, part of the contagion is the fear from women who have been threatened, because many of them will be threatened with the fact, if you leave me, I will kill you. Because many of these men think that if I can't control you any longer, then I will destroy you. Now, not all men think about like that when they're separating. Even domestic violence offenders don't all think like that. But there's a group of men that are very strongly saying that to women and threatening them.
And in a major development, the officer in charge of the investigation has been sacked from the case. At a media conference yesterday, Mark Thompson said the investigation would be looking at whether the deaths were domestic violence related or if it was an instance of a husband being driven too far. These comments provoked outrage from anti-violence campaigners who say they were victim-blaming and making excuses for the murderer. Today, the Queensland Police Commissioner, Katerina Carroll, announced Detective Inspector Thompson had been stood down from the investigation. However, she says he's gutted about his remarks.
I phoned the officer this morning, and as you can appreciate, he is distraught and gutted because of the way he explained it and then construed. As I was suggesting and asking him that he needed to step aside, he actually volunteered and said, for the integrity and the confidence of not only this investigation, but us in policing, he needed to. And I totally agreed with that.
Queensland Police Commissioner Katerina Carroll ending that report by Sarah Sedgie. And if you or someone you know is affected by sexual assault or family violence, call 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or visit the website 1800respect.org.au. And in an emergency, please call 000. Pandemonium and chaos. That's how some passengers have described the scene after a Sydney to Melbourne train came off the tracks about 45 kilometres north of the Victorian capital. The driver and train pilot were killed. The tragedy is raising questions about the condition of regional railway lines, and investigators are now combing through the wreckage of the crash to find out what caused the train to derail. David Sparks reports.
With just 45 kilometres to go, passengers on the Sydney to Melbourne train thought they were finally about to reach their destination. But suddenly, their trip was thrown into chaos.
We're flying, and the next minute, everything went swaying, and we were like the brakes and carriages were going everywhere.
We were probably doing 80 or 90 k's an hour. Next thing, we were thrown out of our seats. The whole train derailed, bits of track and sleepers going everywhere.
When the XPT train came to a grinding halt near the town of Wallen, the engine carriage was lying on its side and remaining carriages were leaning on various angles behind it.
A bit of pandemonium on board. People were, you know, injured and upset, and yeah, it was just a crazy scene.
Canberra resident James Ashburner had boarded the train at Yass, south of Sydney. He says those in his carriage were lucky. Most escaped unharmed. But once they got out, he realised how dangerous the accident had been.
I looked at the loco and realised that I hadn't seen any driver. And it was about that time that two or three of the train blokes and one or two other fellas came out with an axe and had a go at getting into the driver's cabin. I didn't see what they did, but after the police had arrived and there were more than the initial handful of police there, one of the police climbed up onto the cabin with a ladder and was looking in, and obviously then they were working to get inside the driver's cab.
The train's driver, a 54-year-old ACT man, and the pilot, a 49-year-old woman from Castlemaine in Victoria, were killed in the accident. One person was flown to hospital in Melbourne and others suffered minor injuries. The XPT was running late and some passengers have reported that not long before the derailment, an announcement over the PA speaker told them the driver would try to make up some time. Mr Ashburner says he had headphones on and did not hear that announcement, but the train was already more than an hour late when he boarded in Yass.
Then we lost more time on the way because of this and that and various things. And then about half an hour before the derailment, we had had a stop of something in the order of 20 minutes to half an hour, which related to the problems with the signal box at Wallen or wherever it is. And so the train crew had been apologising for this lengthy delay.
The Rail, Tram and Bus Union has released a statement claiming the accident happened on a section of track that required maintenance. The National Rail Safety Regulator Chief Executive is Sue McCary.
All of those things will be looked at as part of the investigation. We also get hold of the what's called the train logger data, which actually records the actual speed of the train at the time of the incident. So all of that will be downloaded as part of the investigation.
Inspector Peter Koga from Victoria Police says he's surprised more people weren't hurt.
Absolutely. I think we're very lucky. It's a tragedy that, unfortunately, the pilot and the driver were killed in the incident, but I'm amazed that the passengers were at least injured or worse than what they were. To have only 11 passengers out of 153 with minor injuries is amazing.
Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack spoke at the scene of the crash, offering condolences to the families.
This is a very tragic day, a very tragic day where we've seen two people killed. Our hearts and thoughts go out to the families of those who've lost their lives, and of course making sure that the welfare of those injured passengers is also a front of mind.
The Australian Transport Safety Bureau is taking over the site from police today and will be working with other agencies on the investigation.
David Sparks reporting. Two Australians evacuated from a cruise ship off Japan have tested positive for the coronavirus. They are among the 164 people taken from the Diamond Princess to a disused workers' camp near Darwin for a stint in quarantine. Authorities say they're confident the new cases don't leave the other evacuees and members of the public at greater risk of getting sick. Barbara Miller has been following the story. Barbara, what do we know about these two cases?
Well, Sam, not too many details of these people being released for privacy reasons, but we are told that one of them is older and one of them younger. One of them has a partner. Now, those people, including the partner, are going to be medevaced home to their home states. Authorities are not saying exactly where that is, but we understand South Australia and Western Australia. That was the previous arrangement. The medevacing is more because of the isolation restrictions rather than the fact that these people are very unwell. They are not very unwell, we're hearing. Now, Professor Diane Stevens is the Northern Territory's acting chief health officer. She gave an update earlier, and she said authorities in these people's home states would decide how to manage them.
Those people remain well and mildly ill with cold-like symptoms, and they do not necessarily need to be in the hospital system, but more than likely will enter the hospital system in their home states while they manage the COVID-19 quarantine and isolation procedures.
That's Professor Diane Stevens. And so, Barbara, what does this mean for the other evacuees at the camp?
Well, these two people were amongst a group of six people we understand were deemed high risk during the journey from Japan to Darwin. They were kept separately. Four other people have now tested negative for the virus, and we're told they'll be put back into the general population of evacuees. But what the authorities are saying is that very good practice was followed on the plane. These people were isolated. Everyone else was wearing masks at all possible times apart from eating. They were using hand sanitizer. So they're really saying there is no increased risk to the general population of evacuees or indeed to the general population outside that workers' camp. Daily testing of all evacuees will still go on. And what the authorities are saying, because of the situation on this cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, where, as you know, hundreds of people have tested positive, other cases are possible. Let's hear now from the Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy.
Because of what's been happening over the last week in Japan and on the cruise ship, it's possible that more people could develop positive tests over the next few days. We don't know that, but if they do, we are completely well set up to detect and manage them and isolate them.
That's Professor Brendan Murphy. And Barbara, has much been said this morning about the overall picture with regard to the spread of the virus?
Well, from China, several hundred new infections, and outside China, a few more deaths. South Korea reporting its first death, two new deaths in Iran and two in Japan. Good news, though, for 260-odd other Australians who were evacuated from Wuhan and are also at that workers' camp in Darwin. They are all well and will be able to leave this weekend.
Barbara Miller reporting. This is The World Today. You can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The Australian Federal Police has confirmed that for the first time it's issued arrest warrants for Australian women suspected of fighting for Islamic State. Some security experts believe this may clear a path back here for the women and children living in a Syrian refugee camp. Gavin Coote has the story.
The Al-Hol refugee camp in northern Syria. It's the reality for thousands of women and children who lived, whether willingly or not, in the caliphate imposed by Islamic State. 20 Australian women are there, along with almost 50 of their children.
They're very concerned about the conditions, being very cold and snowed in. You know, one of the young kids has got terrible frostbite in the hands.
Clark Jones is a criminologist and counter-terrorism expert at the Australian National University. He's also been working in a personal capacity to advise a community group which is trying to get the women and children out of the camp, which has faced brutal winter conditions in recent months. The federal government has resisted calls to bring them back to Australia, citing national security concerns, but it's now been confirmed a number of women are the subject of an arrest warrant. The Australian Federal Police had previously obtained 42 arrest warrants and has now confirmed for the first time they include women. It won't say whether any of the women in the Owl Hall camp are among them, but Clark Jones suspects it's the case.
And, you know, this is the interesting thing with the families, because they're not trying to avoid the law. They are happy to face the law if that's the case, if there are charges raised.
The AFP says all of the women who are suspected to have travelled to the conflict zone are being investigated for a range of alleged offences. Anthony Billingsley is a lecturer of international relations at the University of New South Wales. He sees it as the clearest indication yet that the government may change its position on getting the women and children out of conflict zones.
We know that people have been able to get out of these camps with the help of the Kurds, provided they've got somewhere to go. And this could be an assumption that these women are going to get out. The warrants won't be issued until, as I understand it, until they get to Australia. So the problem is, how do they get to Australia to be arrested? So we need some sort of action on the part of the government to say, well, okay, we're going to get these people out of there and process them as a result of the warrants.
Some of the Australian women stuck in Syria claim they were duped into joining Islamic State. But the Lowy Institute's Roger Shanahan thinks their role in the terrorist group could be more sinister.
From what we know, the vast majority of them, the adult women, went there after the caliphate was declared, after it was pretty obvious what Islamic State was doing. Their claims to have been tricked or coerced or forced to enter Syrian territory seem pretty sketchy on what they've told and implausible.
The real murky territory, it would appear, is with the children. But what does this mean for them and their fate?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been the real difficulty about what to do with the children. And perhaps the family groups can be brought back and the parents go to jail on remand, awaiting trials, but at least the family groups are brought back and they're dealt with separately, children to undergo some kind of de-radicalisation program and parents to face the weight of the law. So I think arrest warrants being put out for the women might be seen as a positive sign for the children that perhaps another step in their eventual return has been made.
Caitlin Jones is the Women, Peace and Security Fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs in the United States. She says up until now, Western countries have shown little interest in bringing back their citizens suspected of fighting with IS.
It is interesting that Australia is indicating an interest in addressing the issue domestically, actively, in a way that a lot of other Western countries aren't. So it's an interesting case and could be an example for other countries going forward. My next question would be, well, are there kind of rehabilitation and reintegration programs in place specifically to help these children and, you know, the women that would be returning. My guess is no. I don't think there's any Western country that has reintegration and rehabilitation programs that are specifically directed to women and the reason addressing the reasons they joined ISIS in the first place.
Clark Jones understands why countries like Australia may be hesitant to bring these women home.
But the thing I want to sort of emphasise is the amount of the millions of dollars that have gone into counterterrorism and counter-violent extremism. Now, if we don't have the capacity or capability here, then that money all has been wasted.
ANU counter-terrorism expert Clark Jones ending that report from Gavin Coote. Living below the poverty line is now the lot of one in six Australian children and one in eight adults, according to a new report from the University of New South Wales and the Australian Council of Social Service. The researchers say the rate of deprivation is worsening in our nation, one of the wealthiest in the world. Madeline Jenner reports.
Australia is, by all reasonable reckoning, one of the world's richest countries, so these figures will most likely come as a surprise. It's estimated that 774,000 children under the age of 15 live below the poverty line in Australia. That's 17% of all Australian kids. And it sets some kids up for a really tough start in life. Anglicare CEO is Casey Chambers.
What we see is we see children who are being kept back from school because parents can't afford to put something in the lunchbox. We see children who aren't able to go on school excursions. We see children who can't have friends home after school because their parents feel ashamed that they can't put some biscuits out with an afternoon snack. And those are the sort of things that I think as a nation we would be really shocked about if we realise that they're happening in our cities, our towns and our regions.
The alarming statistics come from the 2020 Poverty in Australia Overview by the Australian Council of Social Service and the University of New South Wales. It found that 3.24 million people in Australia are living below the poverty line. That line is considered to be $457 a week for a single adult. Professor Carla Treloar is Director of the Social Policy Research Centre at UNSW.
We really need to ask the question in modern wealthy Australia, are we okay with this picture for ourselves that we have persistent and deepening poverty for such a large number of Australians and such a large number of children?
The report also found that the poverty rate in Australia is worse than other wealthy countries, including New Zealand, Germany and Ireland. And it pinpointed two major drivers behind these figures. The first is the Australian Income Support Payment System.
Both Newstart and Youth Allowance are more than $100 a week below the poverty line. In fact, youth allowance is more than $150 below the poverty line per week. That makes it really tough for people to meet basic needs, let alone get ahead in looking for jobs and looking for the types of work that they want. So those allowances are there for people in tough times, but because they are so far below the poverty line, it really makes those tough times way more tougher indeed.
The second major issue is the high cost of housing. Dr. Cassandra Goldie is the CEO of ACOS. She says the report should be a wake-up call for all Australians.
The policies that we've been using for this last period are not working. We say if you're serious, it's about incomes for people on low incomes. They've got to go up. And the other thing, I think everybody gets it. If you don't have housing, how do you build, you know, a better life? If the government is scratching its head about what it should do for the economy, the big things it could do is pump big money into construction of social housing. That's desperately what we need. And the Reserve Bank agrees with us that rather than more tax cuts, you'd put some money in the hands of people on very low incomes and increase Newstart. And both of those measures would help to boost jobs. So there's a triple win there if we really took this seriously.
ACOS says Newstart is a serious problem and is calling for an increase of $95 per week. A spokesperson for the Family and Social Services Minister says the Morrison government is focused on growing the economy and getting more people into work. The spokesperson said the government understands that helping people out of poverty and increasing their self-reliance is a complex challenge, which is why the government has been willing to trial new initiatives to remove barriers to work and tackle disadvantage and intergenerational welfare dependence.
Madeline Jenner. And that's The World Today for this week. The program's supervising producer is Michael Edwards, associate producer Barney Porter, technical production by Amelia Tan and Scott Johnston. I'm Samantha Donovan. I hope you have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
There's been a story this week that's been impossible to ignore, hard to talk about, and very easy to get wrong. And that's the killing of Hannah Clark and her three children by her estranged partner.
Today, what the media gets wrong when it talks about the violent deaths of women, what that does to families, and how we can improve. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.